person?
No. He is busy with your mother. She is sucking his cock to the bristles, Karis, to the root. marvelous tongue, soft lips. Karis felt a rage sweeping through him, and then realized with a start that his anger was directed not at Reagan, but at the demon. The demon! He tightly gripped Calm by its shoulders, breathed deeply, and then, standing up, he slipped a slender glass phial from a pocket and uncorked it. Reagan stared at it wearily. "What's that in your hand?" she rasped, drawing back rigidly, her eyes apprehensive. "Oh, don't you know? Why, it's holy water, devil," answered Karis. And as Reagan immediately began whimpering and straining against her straps, he began shooting sprinkles of the vial's content at her.
"Oh, it burns! It burns!"
Reagan cried out gutturally as she thrashed about, writhing in terror and in pain.
Stop it, priest bastard! Stop it!"
Staring blankly, both Karis's body and soul seemed to sag. He stopped sprinkling, and his arm and the vial dropped slowly and listlessly to his side. "Hysteria. Suggestion. She did read the book." He glanced at the tape recorder and then lowered his head and shook it. Why bother? But now he noticed the silence, so airless, so deep. And he looked up at Reagan, and instantly his eyebrows lowered and bunched together in perplexity. "What's this?" he thought. "What's going on?" The demonic personality had vanished, and in its place were other features, which were similar and yet different, with the eyes now rolled upward into their sockets, so that only the whites balefully showed. Lips moving. A feverish gibberish. Karis came around to the side of the bed and leaned over to listen. Nothing. Just nonsense syllables. And yet it's got cadence, he thought. Like a language. My God, could it possibly be? Karis wondered. Hope. He felt a fluttering of wings in his chest, swiftly gripped them, held them still. Come on, don't be an idiot, Damien. And yet, he checked the tape recorder's volume monitor, dialed up the amplification knob, and was listening intently with his ear held low above Reagan's lips, when abruptly the gibber ceased and was replaced by heavy breathing, raspy and deep. Something new. No, someone new. Karis drew himself up and looked down at Reagan. Quiet wonder. Whites of eyes, eyelids fluttering. "Who are you?" he asked.
"No one, my..."
Something answered him in pain and in a groaning whisper.
"No one, my... No one, my..."
The cracking, breathy voice seemed to come from afar, from some dark, cloistered space at the edge of the worlds, beyond time, beyond hope, beyond even the comfort of resignation and despair. Karis frowned. "Is that your name?" The lips moved. Fevered syllables, slow, unintelligible. And then abruptly they ceased. "Are you able to understand me?" asked Karis. Silence. Only breathing, long and deep. The sound of sleep in a hospital respirator. Karis waited, hoped for more. Nothing came. Karis picked up the tape recorder, gave Reagan a last searching look, and then left the room and went downstairs. He found Chris in the kitchen sitting somberly over coffee at the table with Sharon. As they saw him approach, The two women looked up at him with a questioning, anxious expectancy. Better go check on Reagan, Chris said quietly to Sharon. Yes, sure, Chris. Sharon took a final sip of coffee, gave Karis a little smile of acknowledgement, and left. Karis watched her, and when she was gone, he sat down at the table. Anxiously searching his eyes, Chris asked, So what's doing? About to answer, Karis hesitated as Carl entered quietly from the pantry and went over to the sink to scrub pots. It's okay, Chris said softly. Go ahead, Father. So what happened upstairs? I mean, what do you think? Karis clasped his hands together on the table. There were two personalities, he said. One that I hadn't ever seen before, and another that I once might have gotten a glimpse of. Adult male, sounds British. Is that anyone you know? Is that important? Once again, Karis noticed that certain sudden tension in Chris's face. Yes, I think so, he said. Yeah, it's important. Chris looked down at the blue porcelain creamer on the table. Then yeah, she said. Yeah. I knew him. Knew? Chris looked up and said quietly. Burke Dennings. The director, yes. The director, yes. Pondering her answer, Karis looked down at her hands. Chris's left index finger was slightly twitching. Are you sure you don't want coffee or anything, Father? Karis looked up. No, no, I'm okay, he said. I'm fine. And then, resting folded arms on the table, he leaned forward. And so was Reagan acquainted with him? He asked. You mean Burke? Yes, Dennings. Well, sudden sound, a loud clattering. Startled, Chris flinched, then saw that Carl had dropped the roasting pan to the floor, and as he stooped to retrieve it, as he picked it up, he dropped it yet again. God almighty, Carl! Sorry, madam, sorry. Oh, for God's sake, go on, get out of here, Carl. Take a break, go see a movie or something. No, madam. Maybe better at Carl, I mean it. Chris snapped at him majorly. Get out. Just get out of this house for a while. We've all got to start getting the hell out of here. Now go! Yes, you go, echoed Willie, as she entered and snatched away the pan from Carl's grasp. She pushed him irritably toward the pantry. Carl briefly eyed Karis and Chris, and then left. I'm sorry, Father, Chris murmured. She reached for a cigarette. He's had to take an awful lot lately. You were right, said Karis gently. He picked up a packet of matches. We should all make an effort to get out of the house. He lit her cigarette, fanned out the match, and placed it in an ashtray as he added, You too, Chris. Yeah, I know. And so, Father, this Burke thing, whatever. I mean... What did it say? Chris was eyeing the priest intently. Karis shrugged. Just obscenity. That's all. The priest caught the faint pulse of fear in her tone. Yeah, pretty much, he responded. Then he lowered his voice. Incidentally, does Carl have a daughter? A daughter? No, no. Well, not that I know of. Or if he does, he's never mentioned it. You're sure about that? Chris turned to Willie, who was scouring at the sink. Hey, Willie, you don't have a daughter, do you? Willie kept stolidly scouring as she answered, Oh, yes, madam. But she died long before. Oh, I'm sorry, Willie. Thank you, madam. Chris turned back to Karis. That's the first I ever heard of her, she whispered. Why'd you ask? How do you know? Oh, Reagan mentioned it. Chris stared at him incredulously and whispered, What? She did. Has she ever shown signs before of having a... Well, ESP. ESP, Father. Yeah. Hesitant, Chris looked aside with a frown. I don't know. I'm not sure. I mean, there have been lots of times when she seems to be thinking the same things that I'm thinking, but, I mean, doesn't that happen with people who are close? Karis nodded and said, yeah, yes, it does. Now, this other personality, the third one that I mentioned, that's the one that showed up when she was hypnotized? Talks gibberish? Yeah, talks gibberish. Who is it? I don't know. It's not familiar at all? No, not at all. Have you sent for Reagan's medical records? Oh, yeah, they'll be here this afternoon. They're coming straight to you, Father. I mean, that's the only way I could get them loose, and even at that, I had to raise holy hell. Yeah, I thought there might be trouble. Yeah, it was. But they're coming. Good. Folding her arms across her chest, Chris leaned back in her chair and stared at Karis gravely. Okay, Father. So where are we right now? What's the bottom line? Well, your daughter... No, you know what I mean, Chris interrupted. I mean, what about getting permission for an exorcism? Karis cast his eyes down and gently shook his head. I'm just not very hopeful I could sell it to the bishop. What do you mean, not very hopeful? How come? Karis dipped into a pocket, extracted the holy water vial, and held it out to Chris. You see this? He asked. Yeah? What about it? I told Reagan it was holy water, Karis said softly. And when I started to sprinkle it on her, she reacted very violently. Oh, well, that's good, Father, isn't it? No. This really isn't holy water. It's just ordinary tap water. So? So what's the difference? Holy water's blessed. Oh, well, I'm really so happy for it, Father. Honest to God, I really am. Chris shot back with a rising frustration and annoyance. And so maybe some demons are dumb. You really believe there's a demon inside her? I believe there's something inside of her that's trying to kill her, and whether it knows piss from 7-Up doesn't seem to have very much to do with it. Don't you think, Father Karis? I mean, sorry. You ask my opinion. Chris irritably tamped out a cigarette in the ashtray. And so what are you telling me now? No exorcism? Look, I've just begun to dig into this, Karis retorted, beginning to match Chris's heat. But the church has criteria that have to be met, and they have to be met for very good reasons, like not doing more harm than good, as well as trying to keep clear of the superstitious garbage that people keep pinning on us year after year. I give you levitating priests, for example, and statues of the Blessed Mother that supposedly cry blood on Good Fridays and feast days. Now, I think I can live without contributing to that. Would you like a little Librium, Father? I'm sorry, but you asked my opinion. I think I pretty much got it. Karis reached for the cigarette pack. Me too, Chris said. Karis extended the pack. Chris took one, then Karis, who lit them both, and together they dragged and then exhaled smoke with audible sighs of relief at the return of calm and peace. Look, I am so sorry, said Karis, looking down at the table. Yeah, those non-filter cigarettes will kill you. After that, there was quiet as Chris looked off to the side and through a floor-to-ceiling window at Key Bridge traffic. Then a sound of something softly and intermittently thumping. Chris turned and saw Karis staring down at the cigarette pack as he slowly kept turning it end over end. Abruptly, he looked up and met Chris's moist and demanding stare. Okay, listen, he said. I'm going to give you the signs that the church might accept before authorizing a formal rite of exorcism. Yeah, good. Good. I want to hear them. Okay. One is speaking in a language that the subject has never known before, never studied. That one I'm working on, okay? We'll see. After that, there's clairvoyance, although nowadays it might be ruled out as just telepathy or ESP. You believe in all that stuff? Kara studied her, the grimace of disbelief, the frown. She was serious, he decided. Oh, it's undeniable these days, he told her. Although, as I said, it isn't at all supernatural. Good grief, Charlie Brown. Oh, so you do have a skeptical side. Yeah. What other symptoms, Father? Well, the last that the church might accept is, I'm going to quote now, powers beyond her ability and age. Now, that's a catch-all. It means anything inexplicably paranormal or occult. Oh, really? Well, then, what about those poundings in the wall and the way she was flying up and down off the bed? By themselves, they mean nothing. Well, then what about those things on her skin? What things? I didn't tell you? Tell me what? Oh, well, it happened at Barringer Clinic, Chris explained. There were, well, she traced a finger on her chest. You know, like writing, just letters? They'd show up on her chest, then disappear, just like that. Karis frowned. You said letters, not words? No words. Just an M once or twice. Then there was an L. And you saw this? Karis asked her. Well, no, but they told me. Who told you? Shit, the doctors at the clinic, Chris said irritably. Then okay, sorry, she said. Look, you'll see it in the records. It's for real. But fine, it too could be a natural phenomenon. Oh, really? Where? In Transylvania? Chris erupted again, incredulous. Kara shook his head. Look, I've come across cases of that in the journals, and the bishop could bring it up against us. There was one, I remember, where a prison psychiatrist reported that a patient of his, one of the inmates, could go into a self-induced state of trance and make the signs of the zodiac appear on his skin. He made a gesture at his chest. He made the skin raise up. Boy, miracles sure don't come easy with you, do they? Well, what can I tell you? Look, there was once an experiment in which the subject was hypnotized, put into trance, and then surgical incisions were made in each arm. He was then told his left arm was going to bleed, but that the right arm wouldn't. Well, the left arm bled, and the right arm didn't. Whoa. Yes. Whoa. The power of the mind controlled the blood flow. How? Who knows? But it happens. So in cases of stigmata, like the one with the prisoner I just mentioned, or maybe even with Reagan, the unconscious mind is controlling the differential of blood flow to the skin, sending more to the parts that it wants raised up. And so then you have letters or images, or maybe even words. It's mysterious, but it's hardly supernatural. You're a real tough case, Father Karras, you know that? I'm not the one who sets the rules. Well, you've sure got your heart into enforcing them. Pensive, the priest lowered his head and touched the end of a thumb to his lips. Then he dropped it and looked up at Chris. Listen, maybe this will help you to understand. The church, not me, the church, once published a warning to would-be exorcists. I read it last night. What it said was that most of the people who think they're possessed, or are thought to be possessed, and now I'm quoting, word for word, are far more in need of a doctor than of a priest. Now, can you guess when that warning was issued? No. When? The year 1583. Chris stared in surprise at first, and then, lowering her gaze, she murmured, Yeah, that sure was one hell of a year. She heard the priest getting up from his chair. Let me wait and check the records from the clinic, he told Chris. And in the meantime, I'll be taking the tape of Reagan's letter to her father, plus the tape I just made to the Georgetown University Institute of Languages and Linguistics. It could be this gibberish is some kind of a language. I doubt it, but it's possible. In the meantime, there's a lot that could be riding on comparing Reagan's pattern of speech in her normal state with what I just recorded. If they're the same, well, you'll know for sure that she isn't possessed. And what then? The priest probed her eyes. They were swirling with turbulence. My God, Karras thought. She's worried that her daughter isn't possessed. His nagging sense of some even deeper problem, something hidden, had returned. Could I borrow your car for a while? He asked. Chris looked bleakly aside. You could borrow my life for a while. Just get it back by Thursday. You never know, Father. I might need it. With an ache, Karras stared at the bowed and defenseless head. He yearned to be able to take Chris's hand and assure her that all would be well. But he couldn't. He didn't believe it. Chris stood up. I'll go get you the keys. She drifted away like a hopeless prayer. Karras walked back to his room at the residence hall, where he left Chris's tape recorder, collected the tape of Reagan's voice, then went back across the street to Chris's parked car. As he was settling into the driver's seat, he heard Carl Engstrom calling out from the doorway of Chris's house. Father Karras! Karras looked. Carl was rushing down the stoop. He was pulling on a black leather jacket and waving. Father Karras, please, just a moment, please. He trotted up to Chris's car. Karras leaned over and cranked down the window on the passenger side, where Carl stooped down to look in at Karras and ask, You are going which way, Father Karras?
DuPont Circle, Carl.
Ah, yes, good. You could drop me, please, Father. You would mind?
Oh, I'm glad to do it, Carl. Get in.
Ah, I appreciate it, Father.
Carl got into the car and closed the door.
Karras started up the engine. Mrs. McNeil is quite right, Carl, he said. Do you good to get out.
Yes, I think so.
I go to see a film, Father.
Ah, perfect.
Karras put the car in gear and pulled away. And for a time they drove in silence.
Karras preoccupied, searching for answers. Possession? Impossible. The holy water. But still.
Carl, you knew Mr. Dennings pretty well.
Sitting stiffly erect and staring stoically straight ahead through the windshield, Carl said,
Yes. Yes, I know him.
When Reagan, I mean when she appears to be Dennings, do you get the impression that she actually is?
A weighted silence. And then a flat and expressionless, I do. Karras nodded and murmured, I see.
After that, there was no more conversation until they reached DuPont Circle, where they came to a traffic signal and stopped.
Carl opened his door. I get off here, Father Karras.
Oh, really? Here?
Yes, from here I take bus.
Carl climbed out of the car, and with a hand gripping the edge of the open door, he leaned down and said,
Thank you, Father Karras. Very much.
You sure I can't take you all the way, Carl? I've got the time.
No, no, Father. No. This is good. Very good.
Well, okay.
Enjoy the movie.
I will, Father.
Thank you.
Carl closed the car door and stepped onto a safety island, where he waited for a traffic light to go green. And as Karras pulled away, he stood stoically watching the bright red Jaguar coupe until at last it disappeared around the bend onto Massachusetts Avenue. Carl looked at the traffic light.
It had changed, and he ran for a bus that was now pulling into a bus stop. He boarded, took a transfer, changed buses, and then finally debarked at a northeast tenement section of the city, where he walked three blocks and then entered a crumbling apartment building.
At the bottom of a gloomy staircase, he paused, smelling acrid aromas from efficiency kitchens, heard from somewhere upstairs the soft crying of a baby as a roach scuttled quickly from out of a baseboard in erratic, zigzagging darts, and in that moment, the sturdy, stoic houseman's entire being seemed to crumple and to sag. Then, gathering himself, he moved forward to a staircase, put a hand on the banister, and started slowly climbing the creaking and groaning old wooden stairs. To his ears, each footfall had the sound of a rebuke. On the second floor, Carl walked to a door in a murky wing, and for a moment he stood there, a hand on the door frame. He glanced at the wall. Peeling paint, graffiti. Petey and Charlotte, and a penciled scrawl. And below it a date and a drawing of a heart that was bisected by a thin, jagged line of cracking plaster. Carl pushed the buzzer and waited, head down. From within the apartment, the squeaking of bedsprings, low muttering. Then someone approaching with a sound that was irregular, the dragging clump of an orthopedic shoe. And abruptly the door jerked partly open, the chain of a safety catch rattling to its limits, as a woman in a stained pink paisley slip scowled out through the aperture, a cigarette dangling from the corner of her mouth. Oh, it's you. She unloosed the chain. Carl met the eyes that were shifting hardness, that were haggard wells of pain and blame, glimpsed briefly the dissolute bending of the lips and the ravaged face of a youth and a beauty, buried alive in 1,000 motel rooms, in 1,000 awakenings from restless sleep, with a stifled cry at remembered grace.
Come on, tell him to fuck off!
A coarse male voice from within the apartment, slurred, the boyfriend. The girl turned her head.
Shut up, asshole, it's Pop!
She turned back to Carl. Hey, listen, he's drunk, Pop, huh? You better not come in. Carl nodded. The girl's hollow eyes shifted down to his hand as it reached to a back trouser pocket for a wallet. How's, Mama? She asked him, dragging on her cigarette, her eyes fixed now on the hands dipping into the wallet, the hands counting out $10 bills. She is fine, Carl nodded tersely. Your mother is fine. As he handed her the money, the girl began coughing rackingly. She threw up a hand to her mouth. Fucking cigarettes, she chokingly complained. Gotta quit, goddammit. Carl stared at the puncture scabs on her arm, felt the $10 bills being slipped from his fingers. Hey, thanks, Pop.
Jesus, hurry it up,
growled the boyfriend from within. Listen, Pop, we better kind of cut this short, okay? You know how we get sometimes.
Elvira.
Carl had suddenly reached through the opening of the door and grasped her wrist. There is clinic in New York now, he whispered to her pleadingly as she grimaced and struggled to break free from his grip.
Pop, let go. I will send you. They will help you. You don't go to jail, Elvira. It is...
Jesus, come on, Pop!
Elvira screeched as she wrenched herself free.
No, please!
His daughter slammed shut the door. Standing silent and motionless in the dank, graffitied tomb of his hopes, the Swiss manservant stared without sight for long moments, until at last he slowly lowered his head in grief. From within the apartment, he could hear a muffled conversation that ended with a cynical, ringing woman's laugh. It was followed by a spate of coughing. Carl turned away and felt a sudden stab of shock. Perhaps we could talk now, said Kinderman, hands in the pockets of his coat, his eyes sad. Yes, I think that perhaps we could now have a talk. Chapter 2. Karras threaded tape to an empty reel on a table in the office of Frank Miranda, the rotund, silver-haired director of the Institute of Languages and Linguistics. Having edited sections of both his tapes onto separate reels, Karras started the tape recorder, and the two men listened with headphones to the fevered voice croaking gibberish. When it ended, Karras slipped the headphones onto his shoulders and asked, "Frank, what is that? Could it possibly be a language?" His earphones off as well, Miranda was sitting on the edge of his desk, his arms folded as he stared at the floor and frowned in puzzlement. "I don't know," he said, shaking his head. "Pretty weird." He glanced up at Karras. "Where'd you get that?" "Working on a case of dual personality." "You're kidding me. A priest?" "I can't say." "Oh, yeah, of course. I understand. But what about it, Frank? You do it?" Staring off thoughtfully, Miranda gently lifted off his tortoiseshell reading glasses, absently folding and then slipping them into the slim lapel pocket of his seersucker jacket. "No, it isn't any language that I've ever heard," he said. "However..." Slightly frowning, he glanced up at Karras. "You want to play that again?" Karras rewound the tape, replayed it, turned off the recorder and said, "Okay, any ideas?" Well, I must say it does have the cadence of speech." A sudden quickening of hope arose in the Jesuit, brightening his eyes for an instant, and then dimming as he reflexively fought down the hope. "But I don't recognize it, Father," the director continued. Is it ancient, modern? "I don't know." "Well, come on, why not leave it with me, Father? I'll check it much more thoroughly with some of the boys. Maybe one of them will know what it is." "Well, could you please make a copy of it, Frank? I'd like to keep the original myself." "Oh, yeah, sure." "In the meantime, I've got another tape. You got the time?"
"Yeah, sure. Go ahead."
"Tape of what?" "Let me ask you something first."
"Yeah, what?"
"Frank, what if I were to give you samples of ordinary speech by what are apparently two different people? Could you tell by semantic analysis whether just one person might have been capable of both modes of speech?"
"Oh, I think so." "Yeah, sure."
"A type-token ratio, I suppose, would be as good a way as any to work that out. And with samples of 1,000 words or more, you could just check the frequency of occurrence of the various parts of speech."
"And would you call that conclusive?"
"Oh, yeah, pretty much. You see, that sort of test would discount any change in the basic vocabulary. It's not the words, but the expression of the words, the style. We call it index of diversity."
"Very baffling to the layman, which, of course, is what we want."
The director smiled wryly. Then he nodded at the tape in Karras's hands.
"And so, this other person's voice is on that one?"
"Not exactly."
"Not exactly?"
"The voices and the words on both tapes came out of the mouth of one and the same person." The director's eyebrows rose.
"The same person?"
"Yeah. As I said, it was a case of dual personality. Now, Frank, could you compare them against one another for me? I mean, the voices sound totally different, but I'd still like to see what a comparative analysis would show."
The director looked intrigued, even pleased. He said, "Fascinating."
"Yes, we'll run the analysis."
"I'm thinking maybe now I'll give it to Paul. He's my top instructor. Brilliant mind. I think he dreams in Indian code talk."
"One more favor, Frank. It's a big one."
"Yeah? What?"
"I'd prefer it if you did the comparison yourself."
"Oh?"
"Yeah. And as quickly as possible. Please." The director read the urgency in Karras's voice and in his eyes.
"Okay," he said, nodding.
"Okay, I'll get on it." Returning to his room in the Jesuit residence hall, Karras found a message slip under his door. Reagan's records from Barringer Clinic had arrived. Karras hurried to reception, signed for the package, returned to his room, sat down at his desk, and started avidly reading. But at the end, as he read the conclusion of the clinic's psychiatric team, his mood of hopeful anticipation had slipped into one of disappointment and defeat. Indications of guilt obsession with ensuing hysterical somnambulistic. Needing to read no more, Karras stopped, propped his elbows on the desk, and with a sigh, slowly lowered his face into his hands. Don't give up. Don't give up. Room for doubt, interpretation. But in the matter of Reagan's skin stigmata, which, according to the records, had recurred again repeatedly while Reagan had been under observation at Barringer, the clinic's summary analysis had noted that Reagan had hyperreactive skin and could herself have produced the mysterious letters by tracing them on her flesh with a finger a short time prior to their appearance by a process known as dermatographia, a theory buttressed by the fact that as soon as Reagan's hands had been immobilized by restraining straps, the mysterious phenomena ceased. Karras lifted his head and eyed the telephone. Frank. Was there really any point now in running a comparison of the voices on the tapes? Call them off? Yeah, I should, the priest concluded. He picked up the receiver, dialed. No answer. He left word for the institute director to call, and then, exhausted, he stood up and walked slowly to his bathroom, where he splashed cold water onto his face. The exorcist will simply be careful that none of the patient's manifestations are left unexplained. Karras worriedly looked up at himself in the mirror. Had he missed something? What? The sauerkraut odor? He turned and slipped a towel off the rack and wiped his face. No, autosuggestion would explain that, he recalled, as well as reports that in certain instances, the mentally ill seemed able to unconsciously direct their bodies to emit a variety of odors. Karras wiped his hands. The poundings, the opening and the closing of the drawer. Was that psychokinesis? Really? You believe in that stuff? Becoming suddenly aware that he was not thinking clearly, Karras set the damp towel back on its bar. You're tired. Too tired. Yet the core of his being refused to give up, to surrender this child to sinuous theories and speculations, to the blood-drenched history of betrayals of the human mind. He left the residence hall and walked swiftly up Prospect Street to the gray stone walls of Georgetown University's Lowenger Library, entered, and searched through the guide to periodical literature, running a finger down subjects beginning with P. And after finding what it was that he'd been looking for, he sat down at a long oaken reading table with a scientific journal containing an article about poltergeist phenomena. Was written by the eminent German psychiatrist, Dr. Hans Bender. No doubt about it, the Jesuit concluded when he'd finished reading the article. Having for many years been thoroughly documented, filmed, and observed in psychiatric clinics, psychokinetic phenomena were real. But in none of the cases reported in the article was there any connection to demonic possession. Rather, the favorite hypothesis explaining the phenomenon was mind-directed energy, unconsciously produced and usually and significantly, Karras noted, by adolescents in stages of extremely high inner tension, rage, and frustration. Karras lightly rubbed his knuckles into the corner of his moist and tired eyes, and, still feeling remiss, he ran back through Reagan's symptoms, touching each like a schoolboy, making sure that he taps every slat as he walks along a white picket fence. Karras wondered which one he had missed. The answer, he wearily concluded, was none. He walked back to the McNeil house where Willie admitted him and led him to the door of the study. It was closed. Willie knocked. "Father Karras," she announced, and from within Karras heard a subdued, "Come in." Karras entered and closed the door behind him. Standing with her back to him, Chris had an elbow propped on the bar top and her forehead lowered into a hand. Without turning, she greeted him. "Hello, Father," in a voice that was husky, yet soft and despairing. Concerned, the priest went to her side. "Chris, you okay?"
"Yeah, I'm fine, Father, really."
Karras frowned, his worry deepening. Chris's voice had held tension, and the hand that was obscuring her face was trembling. Lowering her arm, she turned and looked up at Karras, revealing a haggard-eyed, tear-stained face.
"So what's doing?" she said. "What's new?"
Karras studied her before answering. "Well, the latest is I've looked at the record from Barringer Clinic."
"Yeah?
Well, I believe..."
"You believe what, Father Karras? Come on, what?"
"Well, my honest opinion right now is that Reagan can best be helped by intensive psychiatric care." Chris stared at Karras mutely, and with her eyes a little wider as she very slowly shook her head back and forth. "No way." "Where's her father?" Karras asked her.
"In Europe."
"Have you told him what's happening?"
"No."
"Well, I think it would help if he were here."
"Listen, nothing's going to help except something out of sight,"
Chris erupted in a voice that was loud and quavery. "I believe you should send for him."
"Why?"
"It would..."
"I've asked you to drive a demon out, goddammit, not ask another one in!"
Chris's features contorted in anguish. "What happened to the exorcism all of a sudden?"
"Look, what in the hell do I want with Howard?"
"We can talk about that later when..."
"Talk about it now, goddammit! What the hell good is Howard right now?"
"Well, there's probably a strong probability that Reagan's disorder is rooted in guilt..."
"Guilt over what?" Chris squalled, her eyes wild. "It could..." "Over the divorce, over that psychiatric bullshit?" "Now, Reagan feels guilty because she killed Burke Dennings!"
Chris shrieked, her hands lifted and fists pressed against her temples.
"She killed him! She killed him, and they'll put her away! They're going to put her away! Oh, my God!"
Karras caught her up as she crumpled, sobbing, and guided her toward the sofa. "It's all right," he kept telling her softly. "It's all right.
No, they'll put her away!
It's all right." Karras eased Chris down and helped her to stretch out on the sofa. Then he sat on its edge and took her hand in both of his. Racing thoughts now, of Kinderman, of Dennings, Chris sobbing on reality. "All right, it's all right, take it easy, it's all going to be okay." Soon the crying subsided, and he helped her sit up. He brought her water and a box of tissues that he'd found on a shelf behind the bar. And then he sat down beside her.
"Oh, I'm glad,"
Chris said, sniffling and blowing her nose.
"You're glad?" "Yeah, I'm glad I got it out."
"Oh, well, yes, that's good." And now again the weight pressed heavily down on the Jesuit's shoulders. "No more. Say no more," he tried warning himself, yet. "Do you want to tell me more?" he asked Chris gently. Chris nodded mutely, and then, weakly, she said,
"Yes,
yes, I do." She wiped at an eye and began to speak haltingly and in spasms of Kinderman, of the narrow strips torn from the edges of the witchcraft book, and of a certainty that Dennings had been up in Reagan's bedroom on the night he had died, of Reagan's abnormally great strength, and of the Dennings personality, Chris thought she had seen, with its head turned around and facing backward. Finished, depleted, she waited for Karras's reaction, and just as he was about to tell her his mind, he looked into her eyes and her beseeching expression, and instead said, "You can't be really sure that she did it. But Burke's head turned around, the things it says?" "Well, you'd hit your own head pretty hard against the wall," Karras answered. "You were also in shock. You imagined it." Holding Karras's gaze with dead eyes, Chris said quietly, "No, Burke told me that she did it. She pushed him out the window, and she killed him." Momentarily stunned, the priest stared at her blankly, but then gathered himself. "Your daughter's mind is deranged," he said, "and so her statements mean nothing." Chris lowered her head and shook it.
"I don't know," she said, barely audibly. "I don't know if I'm doing what's right. I think she did it, and so maybe she could kill someone else. I don't know."
She turned a hopeless, hollow stare back to Karras, and in a throaty, husky whisper, she asked him, "What should I do?" Karras inwardly sagged. The weight was now set in concrete, and in drying it had shaped itself to his back. "Well, you've already done what you should do," he said. "You've told someone, Chris. You've told me. So now just leave it up to me to decide what's best to do. Would you do that, please? Just leave it to me?" Wiping at an eye with the back of her hand, Chris nodded and said,
Yeah. Well, sure. Sure, yeah. Yeah, that would be best, Father."
Trying to muster a smile, she added weakly, "Thanks, Father.
Thank you so much."
"Are you feeling better now?"
"Yes."
"Then will you do me a favor?"
"Sure, anything. What?"
"Go out and see a movie." For a moment, Chris stared blankly. And then she smiled and shook her head. "Nah, I hate him."
"Go visit a friend."
Chris looked at him warmly. "I got a friend right here." "You bet. Now you get some rest, please. Will you promise?"
"Yes, I promise."
Karras had a thought, another question. "You think Dennings brought the book upstairs?" he asked. "Or was it already there?"
"I believe it was there."
Looking slightly aside, Karras nodded his head.
"I see," he said quietly.
Then abruptly he stood up.
"Well, okay. You need the car back, by the way?"
No, you can keep it."
"All right, then. I'll be back to you later."
Lowering her head, Chris said softly,
"Okay."
Karras left the house and walked out onto the street with thoughts that raced and tumbled recklessly in his mind. Reagan killed Dennings? What madness! He envisioned her shoving him out through her bedroom window to hurtle down those long and steep stone steps, turning over and over and flailing helplessly until his world came to a sudden stop.
"Impossible," thought Karras. "No!"
And yet Chris's near conviction it was so. Her hysteria.
"Well, that's exactly what it is," the priest tried telling himself. "That's it. It's nothing more than hysterical imagining."
And yet, Karras chased after certainties, like fallen leaves in a wind. As he was passing the precipitous steps beside the house, Karras heard a sound from below by the river, and he stopped and looked down toward the C&O Canal. A harmonica. Someone playing Red River Valley, since boyhood the Jesuit's favorite song. He stood and listened until the traffic light changed down below, and the melancholy melody was crushed and overwhelmed by the sound of auto traffic starting up again on M Street, rudely shattered by a world that was now, of this moment, and in torment, dripping blood on exhaust fumes as it cried out for help. Staring down the steps unseeingly, Karras thrust his hands into his pockets, as once again he thought feverishly about the plight of Chris McNeil, and of Reagan, and of Lucas aiming kicks at the dead tranquil. He must do something, but what? Could he hope to outguess the clinicians at Barringer? Oh, are you really a priest or from Central Casting? Karras absently nodded, remembering the case of possession of a Frenchman named Achille, who, like Reagan, had called himself a devil, and, like Reagan, his disorder had been rooted in guilt. In Achille's case, remorse over marital infidelity. The great psychologist Janet had effected a cure by hypnotically suggesting the presence of the wife, who appeared to Achille's hallucinated eyes, and solemnly forgave him. Karras nodded. Yes, suggestion could work for Reagan, although not through hypnosis. They had tried that at Barringer. The counteracting suggestion for Reagan, he believed, was what her mother had insisted on all along. It was the ritual of exorcism. Reagan knew what it was, and she knew its intended effect. Her reaction to the holy water. She got that from a chapter in that book, and in that chapter there were also descriptions of successful exorcism. Yes, it could work. It could. But then how to get permission from the Chancery Office? How to build up a case without mention of Dennings? Karras could not lie to the bishop. And so what facts did he have that could possibly convince him? His temples beginning to pulse with headache. Karras lifted a hand to his brow. He knew he needed sleep, but he couldn't. No, not now. What facts? The tapes at the Institute? What would Frank find? Was there anything he could find? No! Oh, wait, who knows? Who knows? Maybe. Reagan hadn't known holy water from tap water. Sure, but if supposedly she's able to read my mind, why is it she didn't know the difference between them? Karras again put a hand to his forehead. The headache, confusion. Come on, kid. Somebody's dying. Wake up. Once back in his room, Karras telephoned the Institute. No Frank. Pensive, he set down the receiver. Holy water. Tap water. What? Something. He opened up the ritual to instructions to exorcists. Evil spirits, deceptive answers. So it might appear that the afflicted one is in no way possessed. What about that? Was that it? Karras wondered. But then instantly he bridled with impatience at the thought. What in the hell are you talking about? What evil spirit? He slammed shut the book and then reread the medical records, scanning through them in a hurried, fevered search for anything that might help him make the case for an exorcism. Hey, here's one. No history of hysteria. Ha! All right, that's something, but it's weak. There's something else here, he remembered. Some discrepancy. What? What was it? And then he recalled it. Oh, not much. Still, it's something. He telephoned Chris McNeil. She sounded groggy.
Oh, hi, Father.
Were you sleeping? I'm sorry.
No, it's okay, Father, really. So what's up?
Chris, where can I find this? Karras ran a finger down the records, stopped.
Dr. Klein, he said, Samuel Klein. Oh, Doc, yeah. He's across the bridge. He's in Rosalind.
In the medical building?
Yeah, right. What's the matter?
Please call him and tell him Dr. Karras will be by, and that I'd like to take a look at Reagan's EEG. Important. Tell him Dr. Karras.
Got it.
When he'd hung up the phone, Karras snapped off his collar and got out of his clerical robe and black trousers, changing quickly into khaki pants and a sweatshirt, and over these he wore his priest's black raincoat. But then, examining himself in a mirror, Karras frowned and thought, priests and policemen, they had identifying auras that they couldn't hide. Karras slipped off the raincoat, then his shoes, and got into the only ones he owned that weren't black, a pair of scuffed white tree-torn tennis shoes. In Chris's car, he drove quickly toward Roslyn. As he waited on M Street for the light to change at Key Bridge, he glanced to his left through the windshield and saw Carl getting out of a black sedan parked in front of the Dixie liquor store. The driver of the car was Kinderman. The light changed. Karras gunned the car forward, turning onto the bridge, then looked back through the mirror. Had they seen him? No, he didn't think so. But what were they doing together? Had it something to do with Reagan, he worried? With Reagan and... Forget it. One thing at a time. He parked at the medical building and went upstairs to Dr. Klein's suite of offices. The doctor was busy, but a nurse handed Karras the EEG, and very soon he was standing in a cubicle, scrolling through the long, narrow band of graphed paper slipping slowly through his fingers. Klein hurried in, his glance briefly brushing over Karras's dress. You're, Dr. Karras?
Yes.
Oh, Sam Klein, pleased to meet you. As they shook hands, Klein asked, How's the girl?
Oh, progressing. Ah, glad to hear it.
Karras looked back at the graphs, and Klein joined him in scanning it, tracing his finger over patterns of waves.
There you see, it's very regular. No fluctuations whatever, Klein noted.
Yes, I do see that.
Curious.
Curious? How so?
Well, presuming that we're dealing with hysteria.
What do you mean?
No. Suppose it isn't very well known, Karras answered, as he kept pulling paper through his hands in a steady flow.
But a Belgian named Iteka discovered that hysterics seemed to cause some rather odd fluctuations in the graph. A very minuscule but always identical pattern. I've been looking for it here, and I don't see it.
Klein grunted noncommittally.
How about that? Karras stopped scrolling and looked up at him.
She was certainly disordered when you ran this graph, is that right?
Oh, yeah, I'd say.
Yes, she was.
Well, then isn't it curious that she tested so perfectly? Even subjects in a normal state of mind can influence their brain waves, you know that, at least within the normal range. And as Reagan was disturbed at the time, wouldn't it seem there'd be some fluctuations?
If, Doctor, Mrs. Simmons is getting impatient, a nurse interrupted, cracking open the door.
Okay, I'm coming,
Klein told her. As the nurse hurried off, he took a step toward the hallway, but then turned with his hand gripping the edge of the door.
Speaking of hysteria, he commented dryly. Sorry, gotta run.
He closed the door behind him. Karras heard his footsteps heading down the hall, the opening of a door, and then,
Well now, how are we feeling today?
The closing of the door shut off the rest. Karras went back to his study of the graph, and when he'd finished, he folded it up and banded it, then returned it to the nurse in reception.
Something.
It was something he could use with the bishop as an argument that Reagan was not a hysteric, and therefore conceivably could be possessed. And yet the EEG had posed still another mystery. Why no fluctuations?
None. None at all.
Karras drove back toward Chris's house, but at a stop sign at the corner of Prospect and 35th, he froze behind the wheel. Sitting in the driver's seat of a car that was parked between Karras and the Jesuit residence hall was Kinderman, his elbow out the window, as he fixedly stared straight ahead. Karras took a right before the homicide detective could see him. He quickly found a space, parked, and locked the car, and then walked around the corner as if heading for the residence hall. Is he watching the house? Karras worried. The specter of Dennings rose up again to haunt him. Was it possible that Kinderman thought Reagan had... Easy, boy. Easy. Slow down. He walked up beside the car and leaned his head through the window on the passenger side. Hi, Lieutenant, he said pleasantly. Come to visit me, or you're just goofing off for a while? The detective turned quickly, looking surprised. And then he flashed a beaming smile. Why, Father Karras, so there you are. So nice to see you. Off-key, Karras thought. What's he up to? Don't let him know that you're worried. Play it light. Don't you know you'll get a ticket? Karras pointed to a sign. Weekdays, no parking between 4 and 6. Never mind, growled Kinderman. I'm talking to a priest. Every meter made in Georgetown is a Catholic.
Have you been?
Speaking plainly, Father Karras. Only so-so.
And yourself? Can't complain. Did you ever solve that case?
Which case?
The movie director.
Oh, that one. The detective made a gesture of dismissal. Don't ask, please. Listen, what are you doing tonight, Father? Come to think of it. Are you busy? I've got passes for the biograph. It's Othello.
Well, that depends on who's in it.
Who's in it? John Wayne Othello and Desdemona Doris Day. You're happy? This is freebies, Father Marlin, annoyingly particular. This is William F. Shakespeare. Doesn't matter who's starring and who's not. Are you coming?
I'm afraid I'll have to pass. I'm snowed under.
I could see that, the detective said as he searched the Jesuit's face.
You've been keeping late hours, Father?
You look terrible. I always look terrible. Yeah, only now more than usual. Come on now. Get away for one night. You'll enjoy.
Karras decided to test, to touch a nerve. Are you sure that's what's playing? He asked. Othello?
His eyes were probing steadily into the detective's.
I could have sworn there was a Chris McNeil film at the biograph. The detective missed a beat
and then said quickly, Oh, no, you're wrong. It's Othello.
Oh, okay.
So what brings you to the neighborhood? You. I came only to invite you to the film.
Yes, of course. It's easier to drive than to pick up a phone, I suppose.
The detective's eyebrows lifted in a dismally unconvincing stab at looking innocent.
Your telephone was busy.
The Jesuit stared at him silently and gravely. So what's wrong? Asked Kinderman.
What? Karras reached a hand inside the car, lifted Kinderman's eyelid, and examined the eye.
I don't know, he said, frowning. You look terrible. You could be coming down with a case of mythomania. I don't know what that means. Is it serious?
Oh, yes,
but not fatal. What is it, Father? The suspense is now driving me crazy.
Look it up, Karras told him.
Listen, don't be so snotty. You should render unto Caesar just a little now and then. I'm the law. I could have you deported, you know that?
What for?
A psychiatrist shouldn't piss people off, plus also the goyim, plainly speaking, would love it.
You're a nuisance to them, Father. No, really, you embarrass them. Who needs a priest who wears sweatshirts and sneakers?
Smiling faintly, Karras nodded. Gotta go. Take care.
He tapped a hand on the window frame twice in farewell, and then turned and walked slowly toward the entry of the residence.
See an analyst, the detective called after him hoarsely.